Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday morning. It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ. Thanks for listening. With Mark Brody in Phoenix, I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, a preview of the week in international news from our friends at the BBC, and an early Facebook investor tells us how the company should fix itself.
We start the hour week at the Arizona legislature. Last week, the state Senate gave its okay to a bill its sponsor calls the most significant reform to the governance of charter schools since they were established. Critics, however, see it differently and argue the measure is essentially toothless. The bill now moves to the Arizona House, and with me via Skype for our weekly look at what's to come this week at the state capitol is Carmen Foreman of the Arizona Capital Times. And Carmen, let's start with that charter school bill. Is there a sense of how much support it'll have once it gets to the House?
It's still early in the process, right? So there's not a strong sense of how it will do in the House. But the main thing you have to remember is that the House divide between Republicans and Democrats is so much closer than it is in the Senate. So it passed on a party line vote out of the Senate. And my gut feeling would be that it will pass out of the House on a party line vote. Because if you remember, this is something the governor's really pushing for, and a lot of Republican lawmakers have even sort of gotten on board with this idea of charter school reform, though some critics may say, you know, this version of charter school reform doesn't go far enough. But I think Republicans will see it as a way to take a first step and sort of congratulate themselves for taking a first step. So I think it will likely pass out of the House.
Now, Governor Ducey, before the session, talked about how he was supportive of potential changes to the way charter schools are governed. Did he get into details about what specifically he was looking for or what kind of changes he might be amenable to?
No, he has not. He has been very tight-lipped about what he wants to see. And if you remember, the governor is a big fan of charter schools. He believes strongly in school choice. So I don't think that he would be supportive of anything, of any bill or any legislation that was too limiting of charter schools. And I don't think he's commented specifically on Senator Kate Brophy McGee's charter school reform bill. But my guess is that he would be supportive of it because it is sort of like a small first step. It is not a major revamping of charter schools, but it gets something on the books.
All right, Carmen, another bill that has moved this way from the House to the Senate deals with the minimum wage for younger workers and allowing businesses to pay younger workers less than the state voter-approved minimum wage. It was basically put on hold in a Senate committee last week. Any sense of what might be coming next on that?
Yeah, it sounds like there might just be sort of some wording changes that need to be made because one senator, Senator Tyler Pace, who's a freshman, the only freshman senator, he basically indicated to, the bill sponsor that the way it was worded could motivate students to skip school or not go to school because they could be paid the regular minimum wage, the $11 an hour, if they couldn't be considered full-time students. Whereas under the bill, if they were full-time students, then they could be paid $7.25 an hour, which is below the state passed minimum wage here.
So does it seem as though what the bill would actually do would change, or maybe just the way it's described?
Probably just the way it's described. So the critics of the bill, if they're anxiously hoping that the bill won't come back, they're probably going to be out of luck because the bill is likely to come back. I would imagine there'd be a few wording changes, but the overall intent of the bill to pay younger workers a lower minimum wage will probably still remain the same.
And of course, if that passes and is signed by the governor, presumably there would be a lawsuit over the fact that this would change a voter-approved law, potentially. And, you know, whether or not it furthers the intent of it or not would probably be the subject of a lawsuit, right?
Oh, absolutely. I could see this winding up in court almost immediately after the governor signed it.
So, Carmen, you and I have talked in the past about drought contingency plan deadlines. This seems to be the story that just will not end. There's another deadline coming up this week?
Yes, there is. The 19th is the day that all of the seven Colorado River Basin states who've been very involved in this drought contingency plan are supposed to submit comments to the federal government about basically what the federal government should do if the drought plan doesn't come together. But a lot of states, like Arizona, have decided that they're holding off on submitting comments, at least until the very last possible moment, that March 19th deadline, that they can submit comments. And what the Department of Water Resources Director Tom Buschotsky has said, and what he told lawmakers at the state capitol, is that their hope is that all these seven states can come together and somehow convince the federal government that the drought contingency plan is the way to go and that they should just keep going down that route.
Does Arizona have comments ready in the event that the seven states can't get it together and the feds really do want to know what states like Arizona think?
I think that they're thinking in the back of their minds what they would recommend, but do they have those comments down on paper yet? I would say probably not. Because as Director Tom Buschotsky joked to lawmakers, he basically said, you know, well, I have until the end of the day on March 19th, and, you know, I'm going to turn them in at the end of the day on March 19th if it becomes apparent that that's what needs to be done.
All right. That's Carmen Foreman. She covers the governor's office for the Arizona Capital Times. Carmen, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
New Zealand and the rest of the world continue to mourn the 50 people killed on Friday in two mosques. And in the wake of that shooting, the country's prime minister says New Zealand's gun laws will change. With me for our weekly look at some of the top international stories in the coming days is the BBC's Puna Gadusi. And Puna, let's start in New Zealand. What do we know about the kinds of changes to gun laws that could be coming?
Mark, New Zealanders are still trying to process Friday's mass shootings, and an investigation is underway, and one man's already been charged. There's also renewed focus now on the country's gun laws, and the Prime Minister says her cabinet has agreed, in principle, to toughen these laws, the details of which are to be announced within days.
What are the gun laws like there now?
In 2016, New Zealand police estimated that there were 1.2 million legal firearms owned by civilians. That's around one for every four people. The BBC's Phil Mercer explains how the gun laws work there right now.
There is lots of speculation here that perhaps semi-automatic weapons could be banned. As it stands, you have to be 16 to legally own a gun in this country. If it's one of those military-style semi-automatic weapons, you have to be 18. All gun owners must be licensed, but for the most part, individual guns don't have to be registered.
Our man in Sydney there, where in fact the Australians, New Zealand's neighbours, are often touted as a success story. They toughened their gun laws very quickly and very effectively after a massacre in 1996. We'll see if New Zealand can also change course the same way. As Phil Mercer said, the country currently registers the people, not the guns, so a licensed person now can own as many guns as they want. Having said that, it looks like right now, after this horrific attack especially, both the Liberal and the Conservative politicians are agreeing that gun laws do need more restriction. But exactly how restricted, that's what we'll know in about a week.
All right. Now, Puna, tomorrow, a pretty interesting meeting in Washington. President Trump welcomes the president of Brazil to the White House. What are we expecting to come out of that meeting?
Yes, President Bolsonaro, who's been incidentally nicknamed as the Trump of the tropics, he's a populist leader from the political right with a reputation for saying provocative, some would even say offensive things. His supporters dismiss those remarks and instead support his campaign of fighting corruption and supporting what they call family values. He also has a strong affinity for the Brazilian military and has said that the worst mistake made by Brazil's military dictatorship was that they didn't kill enough leftists. Brazil is also struggling with a high crime and murder rate, and Mr. Bolsonaro is in favor of expanding gun ownership as a way to fight crime, opposite of what's happening in Australia and New Zealand, as we were talking about. The economy in Brazil is also struggling. He supports loosening restrictions on economic activity in the Amazon.
What will the two presidents be discussing?
They will probably hit it off really well, to be honest. We're expecting Venezuela to be high on the agenda. Both are no fans of President Maduro. Brazil welcomes the opposition leader who's declared himself interim president, Juan Guaido. And President Trump's administration has been quick to tie Venezuela's economic collapse with Cuba. Brazil has been receiving large numbers of Venezuelan refugees as well, which has caused quite a bit of tension there at the border. We're expecting some strong language, therefore, to come between the both of them against the government of Venezuela from this meeting. Also, there's talk of space cooperation between the two countries. Brazil being given status as major non-NATO U.S. ally, which will also help with future military partnerships and deals for them. But President Bolsonaro should really be careful about China, not to align himself too much with Mr. Trump on that issue, because they don't want to lose China, which is a huge friend and economic backer that they have right now.
All right, so Poona, that meeting takes place tomorrow, Friday, looking a little bit further down the week, is the UN's World Water Day, right?
Yes. Mark, water scarcity and the lack of freshwater resources enough to meet demand in the world is currently affecting people in every continent. And one angle of water which has been featuring most in the news has been mega dams. Around the developing world, increase in populations has put more demand on limited freshwater and electricity resources. So large dam projects have become very popular. For example, Pakistan recently launched a campaign to raise funds, asking for each Pakistani to donate $1,000 to pay for massive dams. As you can imagine, that fund has not been very successful. Dams themselves in general have not been a great model of success. Oxford University looked at mega dams projects around the world and found that they rarely make back the money that they cost to build.
And are there environmental concerns with them as well?
Mark, there are environmental concerns as well. Critics say mega dams are not carbon neutral, they're not greenhouse neutral, the amount of vegetation they kill and the natural resources, and also the concrete that they use, all make them environmentally problematic. Guy Deloney, our correspondent in the Balkans, went to visit a dam project in Bosnia late last year.
Here in the Sana Valley, you can see the ugly face of supposedly sustainable energy. A whole lot of concrete and rock and piping has been dropped into the middle of the river to block it off and create a dam.
They also harm the fish ecosystems in the region as well. This one from our Africa correspondent, Alistair Leithhead.
They say the Congo River could power Africa if it was tamed, and a deal's already been signed to build a massive hydroelectric plant. Ethiopia has dammed the Blue Nile. Tanzania is deforesting a national park for a dam. There are around 140 projects underway across Africa.
As you heard, many dams are still being built in various parts of the world, in various continents, regardless of the environmental, the sustainability, and the financial concerns.
All right, that is the BBC's Poona Gadusi. Poona, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. Pleasure.
Earlier, we talked to the BBC about gun laws that could change in New Zealand following the mass shooting in Christchurch at two mosques that killed 50 people. All of the victims were Muslim. Now let's focus on an issue coming out of the tragedy, how the deaths are signaling an alarming problem and pattern of Islamophobia and white nationalism that includes a wave here in the United States. Kathleen Ballou is a professor at the University of Chicago and author of the book Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. And she talks to Tanzina Vega and her partner, The Takeaway.
We're seeing this attack fit into other patterns of attacks we've seen in recent years, including here in the United States. I think Charlottesville, I think of Pittsburgh. How is it that this white supremacist violence is unfolding the way it is today?
Well, let's start out by thinking a little bit about our terminology. I think that we want to use a phrase to name this movement that is specific and concrete, and that conveys the radical nature of the future imagined by these activists. And for that reason, I think we should think of this not as white supremacist or white nationalist violence, but as a coordinated social movement, the white power movement. And the reason I say that is that when we talk about nationalist violence, most people, I think about the nation as being the center of that term and assume that the nation means the United States. But for this group of people, and as we saw so clearly in the attacks in New Zealand, the nation imagined here is not the United States or New Zealand or Australia, where the gunman seems to be from, but rather this idea of a transnational Aryan nation, a white nation that is bounded together in common purpose. So what we see is the emergence of a transnational understanding that links different white countries together for these activists and creates kind of a world map of violent possibility.
I want to get into a little bit more of the specifics there. We're also now joined by Khalid Beydoun, who's an associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Khalid.
Thanks for having me.
So you have been tweeting about each of the victims since this attack happened, and you've also been receiving messages from family members and friends and victims of the attack. Why did you choose that approach? Why is it important to highlight each of these victims individually?
Well, I think what prompted me to keep a thread of the 50 victims was, you know, first I was doing media and I realized that there was a lot of fixation on the terrorist, his manifesto, his white populist vision, and no attention being paid to the individuals on the ground who were slaughtered by the terrorists. So being Muslim American myself and, you know, hearing a lot of frustration from members of my community, my family members, you know, I took it upon myself to try to give face, humanize the stories of the 50 individuals, to portray them, you know, more than just statistics or, you know, numbers that were rising, as more about the massacre was being learned, to try to convey the idea that these were real people with real families and real stories.
Another thing that we're seeing, Khalid, to Kathleen's point earlier, is this white power movement that's growing across the world. This attack, I'm wondering if you can tell us also a little bit about how this squares with the rise of Islamophobic violence specifically.
Yeah, so when I think of white supremacy or white populism, it's really critical to not think about it as, you know, a fringe movement, something that is aberrant or deviant. It's mainstream. It has a rich history. There's an underbelly that's rising to the fore. You have politicians, whether it be Donald Trump or this individual in Australia, Fraser Anning, who echoed the idea that it was immigration, right? It was Muslims that were the cause of the massacre. So you have this relationship, this bind, if you will, between the vigilante terrorists on the ground and the politicians who are feeding them with the rhetoric and the ideas that emboldens the kind of violence we see in New Zealand. And, you know, part of the white populist vision, obviously, is centered on anti-Muslim bigotry. They view Muslims as a rival civilization, a rival political ideology. And individuals like the terrorists on the ground in New Zealand feel as if, and they write in the manifesto, that they're launching a crusade against Muslims. So Islamophobia is central to this white supremacist, white populist vision.
Kathleen, I want to bring you in here. Kathleen, can you help us understand a little bit about the influence that rhetoric, like what was cited by this terrorist of the president of the United States, how that impacts what we're seeing today?
And I actually think we want to be very, very cautious in sort of painting with the same brush political rhetoric that is doing some of the same symbolic work that we see in something like this shooter's manifesto and the on-the-ground acts of violence carried out by white power activists, which is a bounded and much more concrete sphere of this kind of ideology.
Can you give I was going to say, if you can tease that out a little bit,
yeah,
because
sure.
I think when we hear, you know, particularly when we hear and see the connections between this current administration and white supremacists and white power movement in the United States, it's hard not to make the link to what's happening abroad.
You're right. And I think we should be making that link. And I think there's a big conversation we need to have about the many ways that this kind of violence is enabled and given both tacit and direct acceptance by people in power. So what happens is sometimes when society as a whole sees politicians backing up this kind of violence with rhetoric or seeming to condone it, they think, aha, these fringe groups are going to be happy with this kind of an answer, and therefore we're going to see a decrease in violence, when in fact the opposite has been true historically.
We're talking about the recent terrorist attack in New Zealand and Islamophobia, and we're joined by Kathleen Ballou, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Chicago, and Khalid Beydoun, Associate Professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. Khalid, how did the politics of recent decades influence how people are feeling today, particularly Muslims who are looking for a safe space to live and to pray?
So beyond the discourse, beyond the rhetoric from politicians, which might embolden violence, we have policy, right? So it's critical to understand that in this country, we have a standing Muslim ban, right? So there's laws in place that, demonize Muslims as being this enemy invader that we want to keep beyond our borders. And before the Muslim ban, we obviously had this protracted war on terror. It was built upon programs like government surveillance within mosques. So even though we think about religious spaces like mosques or synagogues or churches as being these, you know, purified places where individuals should expect safety, the fact that the state has penetrated these spaces, specifically mosques, in a very extreme way, and effectively branded them as spaces where individuals become terrorists and become radicalized, is signaling to, you know, private individuals, private terrorists, that you got to keep tabs on these mosques. You got to keep tabs on these individuals praying within these spaces, which then facilitates the possibility of something like a massacre that we saw in Christchurch happening, taking place. So there's a direct connection between rhetoric, but there's also a nexus between policy that enables this kind of thing to happen.
Kathleen, I want to bring you back in because we were talking before the break a little bit about the history behind some of these movements. And you mentioned that this is, you said to use specific language in calling this a white power movement. Is this growing? Is this movement getting bigger? Is it emboldened right now by what we're seeing politically?
I think it is emboldened. I think that one of the things that happens if we name this as a work of white power violence is that we're able to draw connections between the attack we saw in New Zealand last week and other recent events. So just in the last 6 months, the things that should be included in the way we think about this are the attack on the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh and the attempted attack by the Coast Guard officer who was arrested with a plan and an arsenal intended for political assassinations against his enemies. Now, when we see these three events together, what happens is that we start to think of it as a wave of three attacks or attempted attacks in the last 6 months. That has a different valence and brings with it a different set of public resources than a string of reports that portray these as the work of one lone wolf, one gunman, or a few bad apples. This starts to bring us into a position of more seriousness with which we might encounter this kind of violence. And a longer list would also include events like the shooting in Charleston of Bible study worshipers, the massacres in Quebec and Norway, all the way back to the Oklahoma City bombing. And that takes us to a history of white power organizing that has mobilized many different currents of sort of hatred and white supremacist rhetoric around this very paramilitary character from the 1980s forward.
What about players like, for example, Steve Bannon, who has sort of, you know, left the American military, the American political stage for the time being, if you will, and sort of taken off to Europe and beyond? Do folks like that have a direct influence on what we're seeing, or are those two separate schools of thought and ideology?
Well, I'm a historian, and I don't study the current moment in that way, but I think that the history here is very, very instructive. And from the beginning, this is a movement that has been transnational in character. And like most transnational phenomena, that means it's influenced both by inflows from other places. And we could look at, for instance, the influx of skinhead culture from Great Britain that gets instrumentalized and becomes a racist force in the United States in the late 1980s, and also direct exports to other places via the internet, but also via, Aryan nations sent literature and publications to different places in the 1980s and 1990s. Groups like World Church of the Creator and Wotansvolk created chapters in different countries. So an activist in Australia would have been accessing this information and culture not only through websites, but also through reprinted newspapers, sending away for materials, listening to radio sermons, and also creating relationships with other activists. This is a social movement that's always been transnational in form and has decades and decades of experience in organizing.
And Khalid, I want to bring you in here because what impact does that have? I'm still struck with the phrase that there is no safe space. And I think a lot of us feel that way in our homes, in our countries, those of us who are marginalized. So what can the community do, or what has the response been, if anything, to this increase in white power violence?
Well, I think Part of the strategy of whether it be Trump, whether it be, you know, these terrorists on the ground, is to intimidate Muslims from freely exercising their religion, from conspicuously expressing their Muslim identity, from being Muslim, right? They want people like my mom to rethink about her wearing the hijab when she steps out of the house. They want people like my two nieces who are college students to reconsider being part of the MSA, the Muslim Student Association, and to wear the hijab. That's kind of the long game, right? That's the long game of these terrorists. And to be frank with you, I think it's the long game of the Steve Bannons of the world I think it's critical to think about him as a bridge with what's taking place on the ground with white supremacists and trying to mainstream that movement to make it palatable, politically speaking, and to make it palatable to young people. And I think we see, you might want to call it an evolution of white supremacy, and I'm not an expert on this stuff, but if you look at what happened in Charlottesville, right, they're cleaning up the way they look. They look like, you know, J. Crew sort of models on a magazine of some kind, right? So there's an aspiration and objective of white supremacists to move away from that skinhead sort of archetype into looking like your neighbor, looking like Richard Spencer, these individuals that might go to college with you.
And we're going to have to take it there. We're going to have to end it there. Khalid Veydoun is an associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, and Kathleen Ballou is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Tanzina Vega and our partner, The Takeaway.
Arizona is among a handful of states that has not adjusted its tax laws to reflect the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling last summer in the South Dakota v. Wayfair case. That decision generally allows states to require online retailers to collect and remit sales taxes. But a bill in the state house would change that and, among other things, set up standards for how much income a company brings in and how many transactions it makes in Arizona to determine if it needs to collect taxes on online sales. That bill is supported by a group called Arizonans for Main Street Fairness. John Archerburn is a member. He owns Pinnacle Peak Ace Hardware in Scottsdale.
In the U.S., there are 45 states that collect tax. Of those 45, 37 are already doing this. So that's 82% are already doing it. This is a tax that we collect and submit, you know, here in our store, as well as several other retailers, people like Amazon.com. That's in our retail association. So it's something that we pay. In my case, I'll have people come in my store and they'll have a problem and they're not sure what it is. And so I'll work with them for 20 minutes or so determining what it is, the root cause, what they need to fix it, the products, and how to do it. And from time to time, they'll pull their phone out and go, well, I can get those same parts on the internet without paying tax, and can you either lower your price or defer the tax? And, you know, when I say, you know, we can't do that, they leave. So I've just provided, what do you want to call it, troubleshooting process for them. And those sales dollars aren't coming here to support the 27, you know, families that my store supports, or the state infrastructure, the police that come to my store when I have a burglary alarm, or the teachers or professors here, you know, in the country.
Do you have a sense of how much money you might be losing to online sales?
I don't. I know, you know, it occurs, and I talk with other people where it occurs, you know, in theirs. I don't know. But I know, you know, we will see more people staying in the store, you know, when that's rectified.
Do you feel as though the economic nexus that this bill sets up in terms of the amount of money a business has to make and the number of transactions, is that the right approach? Are you happy with the way this bill would set up a system to collect online sales taxes?
Well, I think this bill would work because they've got provisions in there for micro sellers, people, you know, who do limited number of transactions and things like that. So they've got provisions so that when people get to, you know, a certain level, then they have to start collecting and remitting the tax. So I think they've been thoughtful in that manner.
What do you make of the idea of, instead of setting this up now, setting up a legislative study committee? There's another bill that would do that. Have folks who are knowledgeable about this issue really try to hash something out, and then maybe next year set up the actual system to start collecting online sales taxes.
Well, there's a professor from the University of Arizona and the College of Law tax expert who's looked at this and has said that, you know, he doesn't see, you know, any issue with the bill. The Amazon people have had all of their legal people look at it. They saw no issue. We've talked with our corporate people at our headquarters back in Oak Brook, and they don't have any problem, you know, dealing with remitting taxes in all the other states. Even some of the states like Colorado, which according to our attorney was saying, you know, has relatively significant rates or complexity, and they work through all that. And he said here, you know, in Arizona, they just register, you know, all the different municipalities, you know, as they occur.
So it sounds like you don't see much point in waiting around. You just want to get this done.
You know, yeah, exactly. I've been waiting, you know, 15 years for something like this to happen. And I think, you know, a lot of other people have as well.
Let's say that this bill passes and becomes law. Ultimately, for your business, what will the bottom line be? Like, what will the ultimate impact be, do you think?
It'll be a fairer playing field. It'll be the competition that we're used to all the time with all the players, brick and mortar and online. It'll just be a more consistent process.
John Arterburn owns Pinnacle Peak Ace Hardware in Scottsdale and is a member of the group Arizonans for Main Street Fairness. It's advocating for a bill in the legislature to set up a system for collecting online sales taxes. But as we referenced, there's another bill also in the legislature that would set up a study committee to look into the issue and report back to lawmakers and the governor in December. That's the approach Chad Heinrich with the National Federation of Independent Business favors.
Well, Mark, it's pretty simple. So the reason that the NFIB and our small and independent business owners support a study committee approach is, frankly, we are living in Arizona, which is known nationally as we're actually in a group of about four states which are known to be have the most complex sales tax laws in the country. And we believe that a study is needed to avoid constitutional problems with any approach that we might take in a haphazard way.
Do you have problems with the approach taken in the bill moving through the legislature that would set up a system for taxing online sales?
Yes, and you know there are several concerns that we share with others in the business community. So just a little background, the Wayfair decision essentially overturned a part of the Quill decision, which was made back in the 90s. So on the national level, at a state-by-state level, we've been living under that decision from the 90s for several years. In that time frame, other states have made significant efforts to simplify their sales tax systems, all in preparation for someday maybe being able to overturn that Quill decision. Arizona hasn't been doing that, and there are several areas within Arizona's existing laws that would put us in legal jeopardy if we moved too quickly and didn't make some corresponding changes.
Ideally, do you wish that the state maybe had been working on this? As you say, a number of states have adopted laws that allow them to collect taxes, sales taxes from online sales. Do you wish Arizona maybe had been working maybe on that a little bit earlier and could have been doing something already?
Well, of yes, of course we do. And we, meaning the business community, we have historically worked on simplification where we can. The last major effort in the state of Arizona to do a small piece of simplification was done during the Brewer administration in 2013. That brought us in line with one checkbox out of about four within the Wayfair case, where we do have a single state-level tax administration and audit. And just as an example, when we passed that legislation, because of the complexity within our existing system, it took 3 years to implement. So taking a leap to what is proposed within the meeting the court's requirements in Wayfair could be a significant undertaking, and we don't want to do that rashly. We want to do that in a measured approach and study the effort before we adopt anything.
One of the big provisions of the bill that would set up a system to collect online sales taxes sets up an economic presence model for a particular business based on the amount of money they bring in from sales and the number of transactions that a particular company might make. Do you think that is the right approach to look at what companies maybe would be subject to having to collect online sales taxes, or is there something else that you would like to see in that place?
So in the legislation that is proposed, that is one of the tenets from the South Dakota law that they are attempting to replicate in the Arizona bill. So the threshold that South Dakota adopted is what the Supreme Court has, so to speak, blessed. So any variance from that could be up for question. And I don't believe we're exactly mimicking what South Dakota is doing in that regard. So even that decision would be something that we would want to bring to a stakeholder group, want to bring to a legislative study committee to make sure that we are confident that the measure that we put in will be viewed favorably if challenged.
Have you heard from any of your members who are concerned about continuing to wait on this and the possibility of them sort of being undercut by bigger retailers or out-of-state retailers who, you know, maybe have different ways that they collect their taxes?
The issue of parity with brick and mortar versus online sales is definitely a concern, and we do not oppose that aspect of the bill. One item that's been discussed is the inherent tax increase that this would be for Arizonans, and small business has a little bit of an interesting viewpoint on that because we don't disagree that the state has the choice if they want to tax an Arizona consumer who's purchasing something from an out-of-state vendor. But we do believe that the increased revenue that the state is going to see should be recognized. And we should be able to see some reforms and simplifications within the small business community to make business easier to do with the state, because we're effectively collecting those taxes for the state.
Chad Heinrich is with the National Federation of Independent Business, which supports setting up a study committee to look into how best to set up a system to collect online sales taxes. We'll post links to both bills, House Bill 2702 to set up the system to collect the taxes, and Senate Bill 1155 to set up the study committee, at theshow.kjzz.org.
Facebook's dominance in the tech industry hit some significant bumps in the recent past. Probably the most publicized was related to the 2016 presidential election and how the platform was being used to influence voters at times with misinformation. That has led to Facebook being trusted by fewer people, and in part to some movement by Congress to call the company's leaders to testify and to consider new regulations. Longtime tech venture capitalist Roger McNamee knew Mark Zuckerberg almost from the beginning of Facebook and was a self-proclaimed cheerleader. That changed just a couple of years ago, and McNamee has written about his disenchantment in the book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, and he's with me. Roger, considering how supportive you were of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, what clear offenses did you see from the company that turned you around?
I spent 34 years as a technology optimist. I was involved from the first days of the personal computer industry all the way through the internet. I got to meet Mark Zuckerberg when he was 22 and Facebook was only 2 years old, and I helped him solve a problem. I was a huge cheerleader. In 2016, very early that year, I started to see people violating civil rights of innocent people using the Facebook advertising tools. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? There were a series of things that happened across that year, including the Brexit referendum, a situation where the Department of Housing and Urban Development cited Facebook because its advertising tools allowed discrimination in the housing market. And all these things really bothered me. So in October of 2016, I reached out to Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, both of whom were good friends, people I'd put together. And I said, guys, there's something wrong here. We need to get on top of it. But they treated it like a PR problem, not like a business issue.
Well, here's part of the email I'll read for our listeners. Management is responsible for every action. Just as they get credit for every success, they need to be held accountable for failures. Recently, Facebook has done some things that are truly horrible, and I can no longer excuse its behavior. When you talk about treating it as a PR problem, did Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg say to you, no, no, we get that, we'll spin it, or were there actual efforts to try to fix it?
No, what they said to me, they were incredibly polite, but it felt like they were patting me on top of the head. They said, Roger, we really take your opinion seriously, but we've looked at this, and these issues are isolated, and we've taken care of every one of them. And, you know, we respect your opinion, and we're going to give you one of our senior executives to talk to, but there's really nothing to see here. And the executive said, Roger, we're protected by the law. It says we're a platform, not a media company, so we're not responsible for what third parties do. And I'm going, guys, hang on. If people are getting hurt, you need to protect those people. And you need to recognize this business is based on trust. And the business model works because they sell advertising. And the way they get the advertising to be valuable is that they do two tricks that are based on psychology. They give you rewards in the form of likes, in the form of notifications that get you coming back and build a habit, which for some people turns into an addiction. And then once you're on there, they appeal to low-level lizard brain emotions like fear and outrage because those are the things that are most viral. At some level, marketers have preyed on that forever. The difference here is that these companies use surveillance to gather every piece of detail about you. They know all your emotional hot buttons. It's all in a giant artificial intelligence that is playing you like an instrument. And you're not aware of this. None of us is.
Roger, I know these are friends of yours, but was this greed? Was this power? Was this just a feeling they were doing the right thing?
So it's a little bit of everything, but I think the last one is the key one. Mark is an idealist. From when I first met him, he had this notion that connecting everybody on one big network was so obviously the most important thing a person could do on Earth that it justified any action necessary to make it happen. And, you know, in the early days when they were little, the company only was used by college students and high school students from their school email. That meant everybody was exactly who they claimed to be. And that prevented trolls. And, you know, trolls are people who go on there who basically bully and abuse other people. And that's harder to do if you're under your own identity. It's easy to do if you're anonymous. And what happened was, as Facebook started to grow, the temptation to grow faster caused them to get rid of the requirement of identity. It also caused them to relax all of their initially very positive views on privacy. They basically forced disclosure whenever it was possible. And in that process, you know, we got sucked in when it was a good product and when it was safe. And as it stopped being safe, you know, we weren't given a notice. We weren't given a chance to prepare. And we'd had 50 years of tech products before that that you never had to worry about because tech was always something that made our lives better. And so we were very trusting.
Well, then can a company like Facebook or some of these other tech giants be fixed from within? Or is it too late and Congress needs to act? But can Congress really do anything? Because technology changes so dramatically, can Congress actually get a handle on it? Or would that be potential for overregulation, which could hurt the industry?
Yeah, so Steve, these are really, really important questions. So I've spent the last 2.5 years trying to help them reform from within. Others are doing the same thing. I don't think reform from within is working. And I say this because the original issue with bias in the housing business, they claimed they'd fixed it in January 2017, but ProPublica did studies that showed that they hadn't, that you could still do all of the same illegal bias in the housing market. And so I think that's not working. We are going to need regulation, but here's what I would do. I want to remember this is America. We're the country of entrepreneurship. We're the country of competition. And what's going on is these guys are behaving like monopolists and they're blocking competitors from coming along. So I want to use antitrust law where I have a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. People know this is not right versus left. This is right versus wrong. The other thing I want to do, I think there are things that go on in this economy that used to be okay because they were harmless that are now dangerous. Here's an example. Your credit card information. When you buy something with a credit card, the people who process it, which will be like Experian or TransUnion or Equifax, they sell that data to anybody who wants to buy it. So it's possible for any company to put together a really detailed history of your life based on your spending. Your cellular carrier will sell anonymized location data for every single person. If you have that data, you have the credit card data, and you track people on the internet the way that Google and Facebook do, you know everything about them. And so my goal here is to use together to say, look, our priority is to protect the citizens of the United States of America, the 99.9999% who are the users of these products and not benefiting from this.
Longtime Silicon Valley investor Roger McNamee, he's author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Roger, thanks for the conversation.
This was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Happy Monday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, how much attention should we be paying to college admissions processes? Plus, big news from NBC on a new late-night host.
But first this hour, a look at how the local Islamic community is responding in the aftermath of last week's massacre at two mosques in New Zealand. Several vigils were held this weekend in Arizona to remember the 50 lives lost in Christchurch, including one at the Islamic Center of Northeast Valley, where hundreds gathered last night. We're joined now by Sadia Zubairi, a spokesperson with that center. Sadia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about the vigil that was held last night and sort of what happened and what the mood was?
You know, we decided to do the vigil along with 17 other mosques in the valley, as well as different faith groups, because we all wanted to come together and pray for the victims. But we also wanted to send a message of solidarity. You know, we invited our interfaith friends from all different mosques and all different churches and synagogues. We had law enforcement there, elected officials, and we wanted to come together, but not only pray for the victims, but also, you know, send a message of peace and love, and a message of that, you know, we all have a share a humanity. It's, you know, it's bigger than one religion, one background. It's really what, you know, gives us our strength.
Is it difficult after something like what happened in New Zealand happened to have that? It sounds like it wasn't, you know, you're trying to project sort of a positive, you know, uplifting kind of image that we're all together. Maybe something good can come from this. Is it difficult to have that kind of event and that kind of reaction given what happened just a few days earlier?
You know, I mean, the mood was definitely, you know, somber. I mean, we were all kind of crying together and, you know, grieving for the victims together. But I think it's really important for us to know that we're all in this together. This is not just, you know, this is not about one faith that is being attacked. This is happening to different faiths around the country and around the world. And I think, you know, it's very important for us to come together, support each other, and to send the message that we don't stand for hate against any faith group. And everybody should be able to feel safe in their places of worship. That, you know, we want our, you know, as individuals, as communities, and as faith leaders, as well as elected officials, to, you know, denounce any hate speech and any bigotry. Because I think that's the most important thing, and that's the message we all wanted to send.
How much has the issue of safety generally been on folks' minds, whether in a mosque or elsewhere? Is this one of those things that you hope to have it in the back of your mind or perhaps not even present, and yet something like this forces it to come to the front and forces some very difficult conversations and some very difficult feelings, frankly?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we don't want community members or, you know, even as parents, to feel scared when we go to our places of worship and our mosques. It really is a safe haven for us, you know, to kind of leave all the worldly life behind and to be able to have a connection with God. And we are in a very vulnerable state when we are praying. So it's unfortunate that this is now kind of a front and center right now is our safety and security. And I think we definitely share those concerns with our community members. And right now, as leaders of the mosque, the main conversation that we're having is, what do we do now? How do we keep everybody safe? We want people to still be able to, you know, feel safe at the mosque, but at the same time, we have to be vigilant and take action, you know, increasing our security. We're also having conversations about getting trained, getting our teachers, our leaders trained. You know, God forbid we do face a threat like this in our own mosque.
Well, and, to that point, on Saturday night, there was a man arrested for allegedly threatening and intimidating members of another Islamic facility. Are you concerned? I mean, is this something that folks are talking about in terms of wanting to make sure that, you know, if something were to happen, if the worst case scenario happened, that there people really were prepared and, you know, really trying to boost security specifically after what happened on Friday?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is something that is on our minds, and we have received emails from concerned community members and parents. And, you know, we are going to take all measures to make sure that everybody is safe as much as you can be. But at the same time, we don't want something like this to change our way of life, to prevent us from coming to our community, to our community centers and our mosques to pray. This something like this shouldn't, you know, we can't let them win. We can't let hate win. We have to make sure that, you know, we stand strong, and we are a very resilient community. So we are hoping to continue keeping our doors open, and just like we did last night, you know, we opened our doors to our neighbors. And basically everybody to come and pray with us and to be with us, because, you know, we have to be strong, and we have to make sure that their message is not stronger than our message.
All right. That's Sadia Zuberi with the Islamic Center of Northeast Valley. Sadia, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
The investigation unveiled last week that centered on actresses Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin put the spotlight on how wealthy, powerful people work to get their children into what are considered to be top-tier universities. How much money is exchanged for that, and how often are the rules not only bent, but torn apart to get the desired result? And now many people are asking more general questions about the overall admissions process. Here to help us answer some of those is Eric Hoover, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, how fair or unfair is the admissions process at some of these higher-level schools that have great reputations, and to what extent has the so-called celebrity scandal complicated all of that?
The two celebrities in this case, right, I think attract even more attention to the story, and certainly the names of the institutions involved, some of the most selective, prestigious universities in the country. That gets a lot of attention, and that gives the story maybe some more juice internationally. But this scandal raises some fundamental questions about fairness within the admissions process, generally speaking, and they speak to a culture in which surely no one could say that the admissions process is entirely fair. And I think the key here is that if you just look through the scandal and all the millions of dollars involved and all the celebrity names, you do see that there are weak spots, if you will, within the selection process, within the admissions process. And in this case, we see that it is, generally speaking, true that athletic coaches at many Division I schools do have a fair amount of power and pull and leeway when it comes to getting certain students in through what we might call a side door that looks different from the process that a non-athlete applicant would have to go through in order to get into that school. So I think the celebrity aspect here helped generate an extra level of attention. But if you look under that, you've really got some fundamental questions about, once again, who gets in and why, and is that fair that some applicants have an advantage that most do not?
Are these universities, based on sort of their reputations, are they always looking for the best of the best, or is that feeling of, it would be great if this person had some money to just to cynically, hey, maybe build us a building or put their name on it. Has this been a balancing act for quite a while?
It absolutely has been a balancing act for really decades, maybe going back to the beginning. I mean, colleges, there was no golden era in which, one pure definition of merit, carried the day, and then things eroded. There's always been a complicated list of priorities that most colleges have to meet when they are selecting a class. And some of them are very selfless priorities. How can we do better for the world? How can we provide opportunity to deserving students who may not have many advantages in life? But at the same time, there's always been a hunger for resources, for institutional wealth, and that factors into some, not all, but some considerations of whom to admit. And so any admissions dean would tell you, if he or she is being honest, that many of their goals are in tension, if not in conflict. And so even at its best, admissions work really is, there's no way around it, a complicated juggling act.
Eric, does this public revelation give more fodder to those who talk about the ivory tower and how this really isn't for everybody and there it's the haves and the have-nots sort of thing?
I think it does. And I think it's not just the details of the scandal that matter, which is to say the what, but also the when. I think the timing of the scandal is intriguing because it comes during a time of heightened public scrutiny for the admissions process already. We've got two big ticket affirmative action cases making their way through the courts, one involving Harvard University, one involving University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And though those cases turn on questions of fairness when it comes to considering an applicant's race, both cases also do call into question ways in which the system is arguably set up to benefit the haves at the to the detriment of the have-nots. And public opinion polls show sustained skepticism about people's thoughts on what colleges are actually doing and whether they're doing a fair enough job in selecting a class. So here comes a giant scandal that for many people, I think, confirms their at least general impressions that something screwy is going on and something not quite fair is happening when it comes to colleges choosing their applicants. So that I think that just adds another layer of skepticism and concern to anyone who might look at the college down the road or the college in the U.S. News Guide and think, you know what, these people are all living in some ivory tower way up high. I think this confirms many people's impressions, yes, that colleges are out of touch and something in this admission system is out of whack and out of step with what the public really wants.
So, Eric, to the reputation question then, do you see this affecting how college applicants feel about some of these colleges? And how do you think this affects, if in any way, professors or staff? Does it affect how they feel about their institutions? Does that have any sort of potential long-term stain?
It's an almost impossible thing to measure, but we've seen most often in the last decade or so that smaller, large-scale scandals, generally speaking, don't seem to have a measurable effect on applicants' interest in general, application trends. Sure, you might be able to find a student, interview him or her, and say, you know, I had my heart set on College X, and then this scandal happened, and now I don't want to go there. There's probably 10 other people who are undeterred, 10 other applicants who either don't know much or don't care about the scandal and, you know, think about how many months it'll be before, you know, the next crop of applicants are making their decisions. That's a long time, even in, you know, that's a long time in the news cycle. It's a long time, especially if you're 17. I do think the question about professors and people who work at these universities, I mean, I don't know that the scandal has like a lasting impact there, but I think admissions folks will be getting some very tough questions from concerned professors and instructors at any of these schools in the coming months. I think the heat's going to be turned up quite a bit.
That is Eric Hoover. He is a senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, good to chat with you. Thanks for the time.
Likewise. Thank you.
The issue of sexual assault on college campuses has become ubiquitous with certain schools and certain athletic departments. Baylor University in Texas, for example, was rocked with controversy a few years ago when a string of sexual assault allegations, many tied to the school's football team, resulted in multiple prosecutions and resignations of school officials.
And just this year, Arizona Daily Star investigative reporter Caitlin Schmidt has uncovered records containing allegations about the U of A's football players, one that even included allegations of a group sex assault. Now Schmidt is out with a broader look at the issue and how schools like Baylor have revamped their Title IX programs in response. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it and began with the history of Title IX.
Title IX was created in 1972, and at that point it was primarily to give women and men and K-12 schools and universities equal access to sports opportunities. So it included, you know, there have to be a baseball team and a softball team. There have to be equal number of scholarships, that sort of thing. But then over the years, it kind of shifted so that part of Title IX has always been, you know, it's always been gender equity, give everyone the equal opportunity. But, you know, coming into the early 2000s kind of shifted the focus to sexual assault, sexual harassment, and domestic violence, and how those can preclude victims from receiving an equal opportunity to education. So part of school's responsibility is to make sure that those cases are investigated if students want, but that primarily students have access to resources so that they feel like they can graduate from school.
Okay. So in this large investigation here, you reported in Oregon with the university there. You looked at Utah and the university there. You went to one of the places also that made some of the most headlines about this, about sexual assault on college campuses and how that intertwines in the athletic program, which is Baylor University in Texas, right? So start by reminding us a little bit about what happened at Baylor.
Baylor was sort of riddled with scandals about 4 or 5 years ago. Starting in 2014, women began coming forward and not only accusing football players of sexual assault and harassment and domestic violence, but they also later said that the school did not investigate it and made concessions for the players. And it ultimately led to a number of federal lawsuits. The university president, athletic director, football coach, all left the school. There was an outside investigation. Baylor brought in a lawyer from Pepper Hamilton, two lawyers to look over their policies and how they had handled these cases. And the law firm basically came back and said that there had been institutional failure and recommended 105 improvements, essentially. So they certainly were under duress to make the changes, but they implemented those changes quickly and broadly.
And so you've gone there now several years later and spent some time with the folks who are in charge of Title IX there. How much has changed? Has this really sort of shifted the culture there?
It does seem like it, absolutely. I mean, it's ingrained in their culture. One of the interesting things I found was that you can't go into a bathroom stall on campus without coming face to face with a poster about Title IX and the resources that are available to students. The people who I spoke to the athletic director, Mac Rhodes, his deputy director, Don Rogers, and then Laura Johnson, the Title IX director, and they are all passionate about Title IX and their commitment to teaching. And, you know, one thing was clear, they have training every year and when it's necessary, but they said that Title IX for them is a living, breathing thing that it happens in conversations every day. And that's how they know it's working. But I mean, they certainly made a significant financial investment, over $4 million, but they really are monitoring and changing that policy to tailor their needs.
Yeah. Okay. So this obviously was all prompted by your own investigation into Title IX complaints there in Tucson at the University of Arizona. So what are the accusations there? There are sort of a number of cases here, right?
Yeah, we have two federal Title IX lawsuits right now filed by victims of a former Wildcat running back, Orlando Bradford, who's now in prison for aggravated assault. He admitted to choking both of these women. They have both filed lawsuits against the U of A saying that they knew he was dangerous to women and failed to take action. And through these lawsuits, the discovery process, we found that there were a number of cases, 27 different Title IX complaints involving members of the athletic department between 2012 and 2017. So we've kind of just started digging up these police reports.
And now the school has hired a new Title IX director, but they have been sort of difficult, it sounds like, especially in your quest to get some records there. What kind of changes is the U of A making, if any?
You know, I have had difficulty with records and getting access, and that kind of has done an about face since Ron Wilson, the new Title IX director, came on. He's very open, he's willing to speak with us, and he's talking about he wants to beef up resources. He has just rewritten the Title IX policy. It is in the process of being reviewed before we can implement it. He wants to bring on additional sexual assault advocates, more Title IX investigators. He has a really interesting idea of having more internal investigators, but also this external pool of investigators that if the caseload gets too big, they can bring people in so that these cases can be resolved quickly, which is in the best interest of the victims, of course. So he definitely has experience with this. He was Title IX director at Edinburgh University in Pennsylvania, and he's also a former judge. So I think he knows how to look at these things from a totally neutral stance. So I have some high hopes.
So at these places that are trying to make change or have made change in the past, like at Baylor, are they able to actually reduce the number of sexual assaults that are happening and domestic violence situations that are happening? Or is it a matter of improving the ability to report and the way that the school handles it once they do?
So, and that one's a tough you know, that's tough to gauge because we know that sexual assault is so underreported as it is. So it's, you know, when I spoke to Utah, they had said it's kind of a lofty goal to think that you can end sexual violence on campus. But what you can do is make progress towards creating an environment where people feel comfortable coming forward and asking for help. So I think, you know, everyone is definitely making great strides there, but it has been a culture change, even just for that. They're having different conversations with students than they had in the past. Coaches and faculty members are having to step in a different way and perhaps, you know, change the conversation. But it seems like that culture change is happening at these schools, at least, and I imagine it's happening elsewhere.
Yeah. All right. Caitlin Schmidt is a reporter with the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us to tell us about this.
Thanks, Lauren.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. Valley businessman and philanthropist Carl Eller died on March 10th at the age of 90. Eller was known for leading several companies, including Eller Media, Gannett, and Circle K, and for leaving millions to the U of A's business school. He was born during the Great Depression, but benefited from approaching capitalism with integrity. Phil Boas of the Arizona Republic is with me for his weekly appearance to talk about Eller. Phil, you think the timing of Eller's death is somewhat profound in terms of some of the issues we're dealing with right now?
Yeah, I think it is a moment to be talking about Carl Eller because he was one of the really important people in Arizona. And at his core, he was an entrepreneur. He was a guy who came up with an idea and went and made it happen. And he believed in the free market system. And I think it's important now because we're in this moment in American history where there's all of this fluidity in our politics. There's all this churning and anger and indecision and wondering, where do we go next? Mm-hmm. You know, what, and is there a better way than capitalism, than free market economies? You know, this doesn't seem to be working for the latest generation that went through the Great Recession and lost a decade of productive activity and came out saddled with college loans and came out angry and upset about it and looking for something new.
Yeah. One thing about Eller specifically that came up about him was in his obituary, but also other people wrote about him, was the word integrity. From what you knew about Eller and what he brought to business, what made him special?
Well, the integrity was at the core of what he believed as well. And he even wrote a book about it. He talked about it all the time. It helped him really become successful because he could persuade people that he could be trusted. He was hardworking. He was honest. He made things happen. And later in his life, when he got over-leveraged managing Circle K and new competitors were coming out into the marketplace in the way of gas stations that started their own convenience marts, he got into real financial trouble, deeply in debt, and he was able to use the free market system and use the trust he'd built up with people to creditors to get them to believe in him, invest in him. He started a new business and was fabulously successful at the end of his life, built it all back up again using the same free market system.
Yeah, it was sort of incredible to hear that at 62, he thought he was washed up potentially after the Circle K, and then went to these other businessmen and said to them, listen, though I had a problem with Circle K, I will, if you loan me this money, I will pay you back with interest. And he was able to do it.
Yeah, they had to have trust in him. What's interesting about him is he had trust in the system that we have, the free market system. And if you think that we're going through turbulent times now, he grew up during the Great Depression, and you cannot believe, people have forgotten just how bad those times were. You know, the bread lines, the soup kitchens, people were putting pasteboard in their shoes to create an inner soul, just to keep their shoes lasting because they couldn't buy a new pair. And that created all of this sort of political turmoil. And the left was starting to embrace Stalinist communism. The right was beginning to embrace Benito Mussolini and fascism and Hitler's Nazism and all of that. They were drawn to it because it seemed to work. It seemed to keep the trains moving. and here comes Carl Eller. He's just a boy, you know, and his father abandoned the family when he was 5 years old. Mother moves the family to Tucson. They're living across the street from the U of A football stadium. And he's just a kid. They don't have much. And he starts a paper route, and he grows this thing to like 500 different homes. He has to get up at 3:30 in the morning. He's able to raise money to help support his own family. And then he goes into college, and he's an entrepreneur there. He starts what the U of A called all these side hustles, where he's selling Coke to the students in line for registration, and he's selling these and packaging notes, class notes for people, and making all this money in college. Mm-hmm. And he realized, you know, this system works for me. I'm a kid. I start with nothing, and here I can make all of this happen and this wealth going.
It almost feels like he was the type who, the American dream that a lot of people want to have, which is that you can use the system in a positive way, do very well, without being especially greedy, without cheating people.
So look at what, so the 9-year-old with the paper route grows up to head up, during his career, 4 different billion-dollar corporations, Columbia Pictures, Gannett, company I work for now, Circle K, and then Eller Media Company, which was his own billboard company. And that was his comeback. And he was able to sell that at the end of his career for $1.2 billion. So he ended very successful. And and what did he do? He turned around and he invested and put all this money into the University of Arizona Business School to teach entrepreneurship, to teach the system that he grew up in and that he was so successful at.
Phil Boas, thanks.
Thank you.
The California Consumer Privacy Act, which passed in the summer of 2018, doesn't go into effect until January of 2020, but a fight over how the law will regulate user data is ramping up in the California legislature. Our partner, The Takeaway, with host Tanzina Vega, has more.
If you want to know more about the information that websites like Facebook and Amazon are collecting from you and selling to advertisers, well, there aren't any federal laws that can help you with that. But one state has taken consumer privacy into its own hands. California's Consumer Privacy Act, which was passed last year, puts more power into the hands of the Golden State's residents.
It gives consumers more control over their information, rights to ask companies what information is collected about them, the right to opt out of the sale of that data, and the right to have that data deleted. It also provides some protections against discriminating against consumers for asserting any of those rights.
That's Jasmine Ulloa, the state politics and policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and she's been following the battle playing out across the state as lawmakers prepare to implement the Privacy Act at the start of 2020. Businesses say it'll be a constraint. Consumer advocates say it doesn't go far enough, and they'd like to see something similar to Europe's General Data Protection Regulation.
Unlike the European model, which allows consumers to opt in to having their data sold, the California privacy law gives consumers the right to opt out of having that data sold. And it also aims to target the bigger tech companies and data brokers.
So tell us a little bit about what that might look like. So, for example, if I'm on Facebook, would this give me the opportunity to do what? To tell Facebook not to collect my data?
Yeah, it would give you the right to ask, what information are you selling about me and why? And then the chance to say, please don't sell that to third parties.
And that's one of the reasons why, and I don't want to single out Facebook. I mean, most people online, most companies online are using data to, you know, create profiles of us, aren't they?
Right. So there's a whole online personal data marketplace where companies are trading information. We're not really sure what they're collecting about us or why or who they're selling it with. And they're using it to create profiles of our tastes, likes, dislikes, vulnerabilities, et cetera.
What do Californians stand to gain from these regulations? Like if I tell, you know, one of the big arguments from tech companies and one of the big arguments against the GDPR in the EU is that basically it makes your experience online kind of difficult, right?
Right. And so that's what's being debated now in California is how are we going to make the fine print easy for consumers to understand? Consumers don't read privacy policies. So how are you going to give them the chance to actually assert their rights and know what information is collected about them and why? And so there's kind of these battles in these three separate arenas. There's the the battle over the regulations, which is going to be handled by the Attorney General. He has until next summer to craft those guidelines. And then there's the battle over legislation, where privacy advocacy groups are going back and trying to make that law stronger for consumers, and businesses are trying to rein it in. Then, of course, there's a debate at the federal level.
How far along are we in getting something at the federal level versus at the state level? Because it seemed, like you said, California's Consumer Privacy Act is one of the strongest in the country.
Yeah. So federal lawmakers have pledged to draft that federal legislation this year. But really, the main battle is going to be in California. That law covers 1 in 8 Americans.
Give us a sense of the other side. What about the businesses and the tech companies that are going to be affected when this law goes into effect? Don't they stand to lose anything?
Yeah, so on the business side, these regulations are burdensome. It's going to be very difficult for us to enforce. What types of resources is it going to take? Training employees, analyzing data processes, changing websites, et cetera, et cetera. And then will it stifle competition? Because smaller and mid-sized businesses will have a harder time complying with the law than the giant tech companies that have the resources to do so.
What are you looking for coming up? I mean, this is a debate that's been going on for quite some time. You said California is really where this will play out, but Washington also seems to be the place where it needs to make some moves, no?
Yeah, I'll be definitely watching the battle at the federal level. Be watching that. I'll be watching the debate play out. Among the proposals to expand on the law here is one that would give consumers the right to sue over abuses in the law. So that's going to be interesting to watch. And then as well, another one that actually is trying to bring it closer in line to what the European Union has, the GDPR in the European Union. And that would give consumers the chance to opt in to having their data sold.
Jasmine Ulloa is a state politics and policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Jasmine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Tanzina Vega with our partner, The Takeaway. When Carson Daly steps down from his NBC show Last Call, the network will replace him with a voice that'll be unique in late night.
I don't know if this recording.
Your dress is short. Don't know what for.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
Hello, everybody.
Now you know when that hotline bling. That can only mean one thing.
I'm going to show you how to make a Migos song from beginning to end, from conception to music video in 9 simple steps.
That's Lily Singh, a YouTube star with more than 14 million subscribers. She'll become the only woman to host a daily late-night show on any of the big 4 networks when she takes over the 1:35 a.m. Eastern slot. To find out more about the significance of Singh's move to NBC, I spoke earlier with Casey Ifeini, an associate editor with Fast Company magazine.
I think that YouTube has proven, and as well as other social media outlets, that this is really an incubator for a lot of comedians to practice her talent, find their audience, and really kind of craft their voice in a way. So she really is just a YouTube phenomenon. I mean, 14 million subscribers is nothing to sneeze at.
Absolutely. Well, like, have we seen instances where, you know, YouTube stars, people with a lot of followers on that channel, have been able to translate that into success in sort of a legacy type situation like an NBC?
It's interesting because, to my knowledge, there hasn't really been a 100% success story when it comes to particularly a YouTube star translating that into something larger like a TV show. There have certainly been a lot of attempts, and then specifically this instance, Grace Helbig, another pretty big YouTube star, she had her show on E, I want to say 2015, and it didn't go past 1 season. I think she only had 8 episodes. So it's a question of, was it the right timing? Was it the right network? Did she have the right development? Like, there's so many factors that can go into something not working. But yeah, it's been interesting. This is, to my knowledge, like I said, I don't know if there's really been a true success story in a YouTube star translating that success on that platform to a network.
Is there a sense that Lily Singh might be able to change that?
I do think so. I think that when you, like I said, 14 million subscribers compared to Grace's 2 million. I mean, 2 million is obviously not small, but 14 million obviously proves that she has a considerable audience and a considerable amount of eyes on her. And I do think that with NBC's giant marketing budget and plus the other shows that it has in its roster, they have, you know, obviously Jimmy Fallon and Seth Meyers all leading into her 1:35 a.m. slot. So there's a lot of promotion behind it. I do think that there's a lot of energy behind this choice as well in Lily saying she's a woman of color. She's a queer woman of color. She's hitting at all these intersections that people want to hear from. People want that point of view from not only a woman, but a woman of color, and not only a woman of color, but a queer woman of color. So she hits all these intersections that I think could really bring a fresh voice to the late night space. It's just a matter of, will NBC give her that room to grow, to find her voice in the network sense? She obviously found it on YouTube, but I do think it's up to the network to allow her to find her voice in the TV space.
All right, so if you are not one of her 14 million YouTube subscribers, let me ask you first, how would you describe what her YouTube channel is all about? Like, what does she do? And also, does it seem like that is the kind of thing that would be able to be translated to a late night show on a major network?
It's an interesting question because, well, first of all, the type of content that she puts out on YouTube, it's very comedy heavy. She does a lot of sketches. She does a lot of vlogs. She has different characters different personas and characters that she does. So it's very much in that comedic vein. When it comes to translating that to network, she certainly has a lot of competition in that space because if you want to look at the late night landscape in pretty stark terms, it's all comedy in some way, but it's either political comedy or straight up comedy, like sketches and silly bits and things like that. I honestly don't think she's going to lean into the political matter. She said so herself. She posted a video after she made the announcement saying exactly that it's going to be sketches and interviews and that type of thing. But there's a lot of competition in that space with James Corden and, you know, Jimmy Fallon, her network mate. And so there's a lot of people doing what she's proposing to do. And I do feel like there is room for another point of view in that particular space. It's just a matter of, you know, can she, I'm keeping my eyes on it to see, you know, what that's going to look like, because it's a very, very crowded landscape. And even though she has all these things that make her different at the outset, it still boils down to the same thing, sketch comedy bits and things like that. So she has a steep road ahead of her. You know, I follow her channel. I'm a fan of hers personally. I think she's up for the task, but it's not going to be easy because you really need to find that differentiating factor to get people to tune in, because the people who subscribe to her channel, they know what she puts out. I think it's up to NBC and up to her as well. And I think that this is a really great built-in marketing strategy for them to introduce her to the people who aren't her 14 million subscribers, because there's a lot of people, 14 million is a lot, but there's a lot of people who still don't know who she is. So I think that that's going to be up to her and up to the network to really market her, to really brand her in a way, acting as if no one knows who she is.
Casey Afaini is an associate editor with Fast Company magazine, where he mainly covers entertainment. We were talking about YouTube star Lily Singh's move to NBC Late Night.
Women around the world continue in most cases to be paid less than their male counterparts and have fewer options for career advancement. But progress has been made and momentum seemed to be building. However, the latest glass ceiling index released by The Economist says any movement forward has been stalled, with the exception of a few nations, and the U.S. isn't one of them. With me via Skype to talk more about what the index found is Roxana Willis, statistician for The Economist. Roxana, the glass ceiling index has been around for 7 years in one form or another. What is it specifically measuring?
The general principle is to look at the working environment around the world for women. So at the moment, we're including 29 countries and we're looking at 10 different indicators associated with equal treatment at work. And in the latest index, we've seen very little progress in the past year. Some of the indicators that we cover, for instance, the share of women in the labour force has barely moved. It's around 64%, while males is about 80%. The gender pay gap is still largely unchanged at around 14%. The share of women in management has flatlined since last year. It's 32%. And that's important, obviously, because that's a pipeline for women in senior management. We've seen the share of women on company boards only slightly increase. That's partly due to the fact that there's a small share of seats on company boards that come available each year. But even so, that has slowed. And yeah, so just across all these measures, we've seen very little movement.
So of the nations in the index, is there something that the nations that are doing a little bit better have in common and those that are doing worse have in common?
Yeah, so definitely there's a big divergence between those that are at the top of the index and those at the bottom. The Nordic countries do well in the index. They're generally equality-friendly places. They help women to get into university and secure jobs. They also promote women into positions of management. They have quotas for women on boards, for instance, and also in terms of in politics, some of their political parties have voluntary quotas as well. They offer generous parental leave systems. So they subsidise childcare and they also offer paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers. So the Nordic countries, we're talking about Sweden, Norway, Iceland, Finland, still definitely the best places to work if you're a woman. At the bottom end of the table, we've got Turkey, Japan and South Korea. They have high gender wage gaps. They really have quite low labour force participation for women. And they have really few women on boards. For instance, in South Korea, it's only 2%. So there's definitely cultural and societal norms playing a role here.
In the U.S., there's been a recently renewed battle for the Equal Rights Amendment, which was introduced initially nearly half a century ago. So we're hearing more about it. Is that counterintuitive based on the numbers we're seeing, or are other countries really not? Is there not really a push in other countries for this as well? Because even on the index, obviously the U.S. is not doing especially well, but at least there are a lot of people talking about it.
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing that we've noticed in the U.S. is that there is some movement and some progress. It seems to be more at the state level rather than at the national level, and this is what the index looks at. We're looking at overall what is the environment in the country as a whole. So, for instance, last year California introduced quotas for women on boards on publicly traded companies. So that's just California. So that wouldn't show up in our index. But obviously that is progress. We've seen that countries that introduce quotas that, you know, like Norway now has 40% women on boards. So we will see some movement there. But on the whole, there's not legislation for helping women into work, especially in America, for instance. America doesn't offer any maternity leave, which obviously would encourage new mothers to return to work, or any paternity leave, which increasingly a lot of the Scandinavian countries do offer.
How much of an influence is there based on who's leading a particular nation, and how much of it is sort of the rank and file folks at the grassroots level?
I'd probably say it's a bit of both, really. So, you know, a lot of the women's progression for women came from the grassroots, you know, strikes, women wanting more pay, so they'd go on strike. But at the same time, you have got a lot of women rising to the top jobs. So the more women that we see in higher positions, the more women will put themselves forward to do those roles. So it encourages women to progress in that sense. So it is important that we do have women prime ministers, women presidents, but also that we've got people at the lower end and the grassroots fighting for their causes as well. And then the more women we have in positions of power, actually, that they're more likely to change public policies that will promote equality in the workplace.
Can you talk a bit more about some of the policies generally? It could be on specific nations, it could be just generally around the world, that could lead to getting out of this sort of stalled position where things would advance.
So last year, Iceland, which comes third in our index, made it illegal to pay men more than women. So employees have to show that they comply with national equality pay standards. And if they fail to do so, they will be fined. So that kind of legislation takes women's pay equality seriously, and it will have an effect.
Roxana Willis is a statistician for The Economist, and we've been talking about the publication's Glass Ceiling Index.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.